Chapter 2. The Battle for Tirin Qut. On the day John Muhammad was scheduled to die, he awoke around dawn. He sat in the corner amid the darkness until the familiar sounds of the morning began. The creaking of the hall gate, the deep thudding footsteps on the dirt floor, a series of bangs growing louder, and then the heavy rapping on his door. His Taliban jailers had adopted this tradition because you couldn't hear the muezzin in here. He stood to pray. For the next 2 hours it was quiet. Then the sounds came again. Muhammad quickly groped around until he found the ornamental box where he had hidden the money. The door swung open, and the hallway's dull light filled the room. Grabbing his jerry can, he followed the guards through the windowless corridor. He entered a large room of yellowing tiles and buzzing flies, where prisoners were hunched over and whispering softly. They were brought here daily to empty their cans, which they used to relieve themselves. With no drains, the effluent sat in puddles, sometimes for days, until one of the men was ordered to scrub the floor clean. John Muhammad retrieved the money he had concealed in his pants and quickly stuffed it into the fist of another prisoner. It was everything he had, $2,000, collected patiently from family visits and the sale of contraband over the last year.
"It's yours now," he whispered. "Take it."
But he had been spotted. The guards surrounded him, and before he knew it, he was thrown against the wall, kicked on the shins, and slapped across the face. He was used to such impromptu beatings by now. When he was first brought to this Taliban prison, he had been thrown into a tiny room and shackled to the wall. Then the guards, mere teenagers, had entered with glass-studded belts. They came every day. By the time they left, he could barely stand. Now and then they even forbade him from praying. It was the one thing he couldn't live without. After 15 days, he was broken, sobbing and begging God to let him die. That had been a year ago. Now, on December 5, 2001, his desperate plea was about to be answered. The American invasion was almost 2 months old, but here in Kandahar, the Taliban were still in charge and eager to clear their prison of potential troublemakers. Back in his cell, John Muhammad paced and prayed and thumbed his worry beads. Then he sat down against the wall, staring at the door. At that moment, his children were probably out working the farm. So too were his cousins and friends, except for a few who had most likely fled the country or were hiding in the mountains. He'd had no news from any of them for months. In fact, he'd had no news at all from the outside world. He continued to pray. Hours passed, and then he again heard the crescendo of approaching steps. The door swung open. John Muhammad looked at the guards and then stood up and followed them. He wanted to be brave, stoic even, so that everyone would know what kind of man he was, so that his family would speak proudly of him for generations. But it was hard. As he was led past the cells of men he'd gotten to know from their time scrubbing jerry cans, he lost control. He found himself shouting, "Don't leave anything for these dogs!" In response, inmates banged on their doors. A few hollered, "God is great!" He stepped outside into an open courtyard under the blazing Kandahar sun. The fresh air felt pure and clean. From another section of the prison, guards brought out Muhammad Nabi, a former enemy. It had been a year since John Muhammad had seen him. Soon the warden came out, an old man with flaking skin and a cold stare, surrounded by gun-toting talibs. He had overseen much torture and humiliation, taking, it seemed, an almost sadistic pleasure in it all. But now he seemed nervous. 10 minutes passed. More guards stepped into the sunlight to watch. John Muhammad kept his gaze fixed on his feet. Everyone was quiet. The armed guards assembled, and he was pushed with effort to the wall. Once things had been different. You could have found John Muhammad sitting on plush velvet cushions, his arms folded across his massive lap, surrounded by friends, nephews, and hangers-on who listened with admiration to his every word. For many years, he stood at the center of all things political in Uruzgan province, a mountainous little corner of southern Afghanistan. His had been a rags-to-guns-to-riches tale that could only have happened in this country. A school janitor, when the Soviets invaded, Muhammad had joined the Mujahideen, the Holy Warriors, CIA-backed Islamist rebels fighting against the Russians, and quickly rose to commander. In those days, such a climb was possible if you had charisma and political skill, qualities that, it was said, he wielded with particular success. By the early 1990s, with the Soviets gone, he was governing Uruzgan and commanding the loyalty of thousands of men. Yet Uruzgan, like much of the country, plunged into civil war after the Soviet withdrawal, and various Mujahideen groups vied to depose him. When the Taliban movement erupted in 1994 and swept through the province, Muhammad was stripped of his post and his weapons. He joined an underground anti-Taliban network that, unlike the Northern Alliance, was cut from the same cloth as the Taliban, ethnic Pashtuns from the Deep South. This Southern Alliance was headquartered in the Pakistani city of Quetta, where, in a stately home surrounded by bougainvilleas and orchids, there lived a former humanitarian worker named Hamid Karzai. The scion of an elite Kandahar family, Karzai was weaving together a network of tribal elders and former anti-Soviet commanders who shared his driving desire to overthrow the Taliban. "Hamid hated them," his brother Ahmed Wali told me. "He so badly wanted Afghanistan to join the international community. He didn't want his country to be a pariah state." The alliance attracted dozens of important figures, but none were more crucial to Karzai than John Muhammad, the key node in a prodigious web of contacts throughout the South. The two formed an unlikely pair, a rakish, worldly college graduate and an illiterate, rough-hewn guerrilla. Yet they stood united in their belief in the power of tradition to deliver their country from what they saw as the Taliban's alien impositions. Hailing from the same Pashtun tribe, the Popalzai, the two carried themselves, in the words of Ahmed Wali, like brothers. Their bond had been forged on the front lines of the anti-Soviet war. Back then, Karzai, who worked for a Pakistan-based NGO, would slip into Uruzgan to deliver humanitarian assistance under Muhammad's protection. Once, as they were crossing a mountain defile, a rival Mujahideen group, presumably after the aid themselves, opened fire. While his men fought off the ambush, Muhammad spirited Karzai away to safety. Afterward, Karzai tearfully hugged his friend and swore that he would never forget what he had done. Under the Taliban, Muhammad would secretly trek from Uruzgan to Pakistan to meet Karzai and plot the government's overthrow, slipping past authorities using every bit of ingenuity he could muster. Once he bribed officials to plant false news of his whereabouts on the radio. Another time, he passed off his old Soviet-era war wounds as new injuries, claiming to be heading to Pakistan for treatment. By 1999, however, the Taliban was tightening the clamps on all opposition activity. That year, assassins gunned down Abdul Ahad Karzai, Hamid's well-known father, for his anti-government stance. Not long after, John Muhammad was arrested in his Uruzgan home and thrown into prison in Kandahar. News of the 9/11 attacks and the American invasion never reached his cell, and in October 2001, he was informed of his scheduled execution. From the moment his friend had been arrested, Karzai vowed to do whatever it took to save him and his country from the Taliban. His plan hinged on a belief in tribal power. The Taliban were uncultured clerics who had upended the social order, but tribal elders, the guardians of tradition, could stir a counter-revolution. So Karzai spent months fostering a network of contacts in the heart of Taliban country, meeting them regularly in Pakistan to earn their trust and win their backing, waiting for the right time to foment an uprising. Now, with the American invasion imminent, he finally saw a chance to put his long-cultivated vision into effect. With his urbane, professorial ways, however, Karzai was not a likely man of action. For a generation, the country's major figures had been fighters, war heroes, or villains, depending on where you stood. But Karzai's close call in Uruzgan was one of the few tastes of actual combat. Instead, he had worked in a minor political capacity for the Mujahideen, mainly in Pakistan, which left his name absent from most histories of the Soviet war. Nor did he possess the aristocratic statue of his father, leader of the politically influential Popalzai. Friends knew him to be mercurial, edgy, and in a pinch, given to tearful outbursts like a spoiled child, according to a former aide. Still, he could show flashes of brio when it mattered most. After his father's assassination, for example, he had defied Taliban threats and led a funeral procession into Kandahar. That daring march was something of a political coup, raising his stock in the opposition and prompting his coronation as head of the tribe. In politics, as on the battlefield, timing was key. With the American campaign about to kick off, he knew that everything depended on his ability to convince the United States that an uprising was possible. Yet even though Washington was actively seeking a Pashtun counterweight to the Northern Alliance, American officials were skeptical. Karzai had few contacts outside of the CIA, which made him a relative unknown in Washington. It would not be easy, especially with John Muhammad behind bars. But given his hard-won network of tribal allies on the ground, Karzai was sure the people would be ready. They just needed a leader. As the American bombing commenced, Karzai decided to make his move. He would infiltrate Taliban country himself to spark a tribal insurrection, with or without help. Only then did the CIA sign off on his plot, equipping him with satellite phones and bags of cash. "I thought he was mad," his brother Ahmed Wali recalled. "It was a suicide mission, and we begged him not to go. But when Hamid gets an idea in his head, he listens to no one." On a morning in mid-October, Karzai and a few aides, with shaggy beards and large turbans, mounted old motorcycles and slipped across the border into Kandahar province. Capture meant certain execution. They rode along the cracked highway, past scrubland dotted with ramshackle homes. By lunchtime, they had made it to Kandahar City and spent the day there in hiding. The next afternoon, they headed out by car toward the clay-colored cliffs of northern Kandahar. Just beyond lay Uruzgan, home of many Taliban leaders and key to Karzai's plan. If he could launch a rebellion there, in the Taliban heartland, the regime would never recover. Night was drawing near when they saw flashing lights ahead, a Taliban roadblock. Karzai covered his face and sat quietly in the back. A Taliban guard pointed to the large sack on the seat beside him, containing the CIA-supplied satellite phones, and said, "Open that up." They panicked.
"There are women's cosmetics in there," said Mohammed Shah, Karzai's security guard, playing on cultural prohibitions against unrelated men handling women's intimate possessions.
The guards looked unconvinced.
"I started begging them, negotiating with them, trying everything," Shah recalled. "I was sweating. It seemed like the end. I was crying and telling them that my family members had been killed in the American bombings."
The guards seemed puzzled, and suddenly it dawned on Shah that the soldiers at this isolated outpost had not the slightest idea what was happening on the front lines, where their movement was rapidly crumbling under the power of American bombs. Shah quickly explained that airstrikes were flattening military targets in province after province, and that Mullah Omar was nowhere to be found. The guards looked shaken. When Shah began insisting that an airstrike could come at any minute, the soldiers waved them on. Later that evening, the men arrived in Uruzgan, driving with headlights off through the back roads and country lanes. They were guests in the houses of friendly elders and mullahs, sleeping in a different bed every night for security. At each stop, Karzai laid out his plan. The elders listened politely, but it soon became apparent that here, Karzai's grand vision of a Taliban-free future meant little. Everyone knew what happened if you stood against the Taliban. You swung from a tree. Karzai's tiny band of insurgents seemed impotent, even pathetic in the face of such repression. The elders understood what Karzai did not yet seem to grasp. Political victories in southern Afghanistan came not to those with the most inspiring ideas or far-reaching programs, but to those with the deepest pockets and biggest guns. And that was something only the Americans could deliver.
"You have a phone," one of the elders reportedly told Karzai. "Have the Americans bomb the Taliban command here."
Karzai answered that he could not do that.
"Then you will never win," the elder replied.
Soon, word came that the Taliban had learned of their presence, and Karzai's team fled into the mountains. By the next day, The Taliban had surrounded the area and were closing in fast.
It was bleak, an aide said later. We were on the verge of a complete disaster.
Finally, Karzai switched on his satellite phone and dialed the CIA in Pakistan. Helicopters were rushed in for a nighttime weapons drop, and the freshly armed insurgents managed to fend off the Taliban and escape farther upland. Over the next week, they were spirited from one remote safe house to the next, always a village ahead of their pursuers. At each stop, not a single local stepped forward to join them. Weary and dejected, the team settled into a remote mountain fastness to regroup. Once more, the Taliban caught wind of their location.
We had maybe an hour to live, Shah recalled. I was thinking of my family.
Again, Karzai dialed the CIA. This time, in the nighttime blackness, he was plucked from the wilderness by a team of Navy SEALs and covertly choppered to a secret U.S. base in Jacobabad, Pakistan. The conclusion was unavoidable. Karzai's plan, 2 years in the making, had failed. The Taliban maintained their vice-like grip on the south, there was no southern alliance to speak of, and John Muhammad remained in prison, awaiting his execution. Years later, in an ill-lit hotel bar in Washington, D.C., I met Lieutenant Colonel Jason Amerine, the man who would help turn Karzai's fortunes around. A Green Beret with the 5th Special Forces Group, Amerine had an action figure's contours and boot camp posture, forged by years of training as a specialist in risky parachute insertions behind enemy lines. His unit had deployed to Jacobabad shortly after the 9/11 attacks, and he first met Karzai on the night of his rescue. No one really believed in Hamid on our side, Amerine recalled. When I was sent down, they said, have your team see who this guy is, but don't do anything crazy. Amerine, however, sensed something exceptional in the guerrilla leader. He wasn't your typical Afghan warlord, not with his bookish cultivation and soft-spoken mien. In a word, said Amerine, he was a statesman. And Karzai's unwavering belief in a tribal uprising, despite his setbacks, was undeniably impressive, even though Amerine knew that the odds weren't in his favor. Karzai was insisting that the uprising had foundered only because he had failed to demonstrate that American power stood behind him. So he floated an even more daring idea. He would return to Uruzgan, this time with American soldiers by his side. Capturing the province, he promised, would rip the heart out of the Taliban and usher in the fall of Kandahar. Even with Uruzgan elders clamoring for American support, however, Karzai had an obvious image problem on his hands. Every Afghan leader since the 1970s had lived and died with foreign backing, and many of them had plotted their coups and revolutions from Pakistan. How was he any different? His plan needed a nationalist gloss, a way to maintain the fiction of a homegrown uprising, if it was to have an air of legitimacy in the eyes of the country and the world. Ever the politician, Karzai got on his satellite phone with CNN and the BBC, proclaiming that he was on the run in the Afghan mountains, when in fact he was safely ensconced at a CIA airbase in Pakistan. Meanwhile, it was becoming clear to Washington that without a Pashtun proxy, the war could take a dangerous turn. With Kabul's fall imminent, the Northern Alliance was openly hinting that after taking the capital, they planned to press south until the whole country was liberated, an advance certain to spark a civil war with the Pashtun-dominated south. Karzai's plot received the green light. In the pre-dawn stillness of November 14th, 5 Black Hawk helicopters alighted on a mountaintop in central Uruzgan. Jason Amerine and 9 other Green Berets trekked down the slope, bringing with them CIA agents, Delta Force commanders, and Hamid Karzai. They found their way to a small cove, were billeted in the residence of a friendly elder, and waited. They were miles from the nearest town, deep in Taliban country, not far from Mullah Omar's childhood home. Locals would join them, Karzai promised, so Amerine planned to spend weeks, if not months, training an insurgent force. Through it all, they would have to somehow avoid Taliban detection. For 2 days, farmers came, took weapons, and disappeared into their villages. Most of them never returned. Then Karzai learned that the Taliban mayor of Tirinkot, Uruzgan's capital, had either been deposed or had fled, leaving the town in the hands of its residents. It was not what Amarine wanted to hear. He still lacked a fighting force, and without adequate intelligence, heading into Tirin Khat could be a suicide mission. But he was certain that the Taliban would send reinforcements, and without help, the town would be crushed. He'd have to move fast. That evening, the Green Berets led Karzai and his smattering of guerrilla fighters in a caravan of pickup trucks, vans, donkeys, and horses on a four-hour journey across Uruzgan's parched moonscape. Upon arriving at the provincial capital, they found an adobe city, a warren of sienna-hued compounds surrounded by mud walls, each indistinguishable from the next. "Hamid had warned us there would be celebratory fire," Amarine recalled. "But when we got to town, there was nobody on the streets. It was a ghost town. That's when I knew it was a precarious situation." The team took over a local residence and set up a command center. Then Amarine left his men and followed the insurgents through the darkened streets, past shuttered one-room shops, until they arrived at a squat concrete building. It was the governor's mansion. Karzai was already inside, seated with graybeards and stately-looking men in turbans and waistcoats. Some had taken part in whatever machinations had resulted in the mayor's departure. Others had only emerged after the changeover. Some had once been Karzai's enemies because of his friendship with John Muhammad, their rival from the Civil War days. But for now, in the shadow of American power, old grudges were overlooked. The Afghans were just settling down to end their Ramadan fast when Karzai broke the news. A large Taliban convoy was en route from Kandahar to recapture the town, and they would likely arrive sometime in the morning. It was exactly as Amarine had feared. He was invited to stay and eat, but he was in no mood for dinner. It was already close to midnight, and, judging by the map, the enemy could arrive as soon as daybreak. A large convoy, that meant hundreds or even thousands of enemy troops, against 12 Special Forces soldiers and maybe 30 ragtag Afghan militiamen, if Karzai could muster even that. Back at the command center, Amarine relayed the news to a roomful of silent Green Berets. Men pored over maps, assessing possible Taliban infiltration routes. Incoming intelligence was now suggesting a convoy of nearly 100 trucks. Amarine looked at the dozen men in the room. There was only one equalizer in a situation like this. Shortly after 1:30 a.m., Sergeant Alex Yoshimoto, an Air Force combat controller, received word that a patrolling F-18 fighter jet had spotted 8 trucks speeding toward Uruzgan. It might be the lead element of the convoy. Yoshimoto looked at Amarine. "Are we clear to engage?" Amarine was a man of solidity, a fighter who thought deeply about the conduct and meaning of war. With a bachelor's degree in Arabic, he had a facility with foreign cultures rare for a soldier. He quoted Tennyson and the Stoics and spoke of duty and honor. Now, for the first time in this mission, he faced the grim calculus of wartime, where a mistake could wipe out whole families, or conversely, throw your own men into danger. In the end, for him, as for ground commanders everywhere, the choice was never really in doubt. He told Yoshimoto, "Smoke 'em." What could possibly compel anyone to face the might of American air power? It was something I often wondered as I followed the invasion in the news. Back then, every day seemed to bring reports of dozens or hundreds of Taliban mowed down, only to have more of them sprout anew days later. They had the faceless quality of old Hollywood henchmen, always willing to sacrifice themselves in a mindless drive to satisfy some devious master. That certainly didn't sound like anyone I'd ever met, and it was one of the things I found most interesting about the Taliban. Years later, I asked Jason Amarine for his thoughts on the enemy. "For 10 years I had a lot of questions and what-ifs," he said. "You wonder who they were really, and what they were after, what they were really about." Amarine had come to Afghanistan because, on some level, he felt he was responding to his country's needs after 9/11. It seemed to me that his counterpart, the Taliban commander rushing in to retake Tirin Khat, might, in a way difficult for us to grasp, feel similarly that he too might regard himself as responding to his country's needs, or whatever warped perception of these needs he held. When I mentioned this to Amarine in the hotel bar, He set his whiskey down and stared hard at the table. Then he said, "You know, I wish I could meet him, sit down and talk to him, or at least find out somehow what he was thinking." In 2011, I visited the guest house of a tribal elder living in Kandahar City. Men sat in the shade of the porch out front, sipping their tea and fanning themselves, looking on wordlessly as I approached. They were wrapped in patus, the woolen shawls customary in those parts, and their beards glistened with sweat. It was past noon. The street outside was still and desolate, and the people inside were readying themselves to sleep the sleep of a Kandahar summer's day. Mullah Manan rose nervously to greet me, his patu concealing everything but his eyes and forehead. He spoke quietly and with great precision, as if under examination. When he removed his shawl, it revealed a gaunt frame, high cheekbones, and shy eyes. Back in 2001, he said, he had helped lead the Taliban's push to retake Tirinkot. He was, in other words, Jason Amerine's counterpart. "I knew Karzai was up there with some fighters," he said. Refusing a chair, sitting in them wasn't his habit, he instead curled up on the floor in the corner, his eyes on his lap as he spoke. "We had all the intelligence, so my job was to capture the town and get rid of him." As Jason Amerine and Karzai pulled into Tirinkot, Mullah Manan's soldiers, nearly 1,000 of them, had climbed onto dozens upon dozens of flatbed trucks and armored personnel carriers and Hilux pickups, some fitted with anti-aircraft guns, and headed north from their Kandahar base. They drove along dirt roads, kicking up plumes of dust that could be seen for miles. By early evening, they had reached the red foothills of Uruzgan's southern border. The mountain shadows were running long over the land, and Manan found his thoughts turning to mealtime after the day's Ramadan fast. They stopped at a tiny roadside village with a lone restaurant, and the crowd of soldiers soon overwhelmed its supplies and began dipping into their own provisions for the coming days. Manan knew that they'd probably have to spend a few nights in Tirinkot, so he radioed back to his base in Kandahar to request additional meal rations. An 8-truck convoy carrying food and blankets was promptly dispatched. After breaking their fast, the soldiers stretched out on the gravel road, leaning against their truck tires, drowsy with food. On the horizon, the dark forms of Uruzgan's mountains stood waiting. As a native son, Manan understood the province well. He'd grown up an illiterate farmer and joined the Taliban after witnessing the criminality of the Mujahideen warlords. Now he found himself in charge of hundreds of lives, but that wasn't troubling in the least, for the Tirinkot he knew was an unimpressive little town with unimpressive defenses. An old rusted anti-tank weapon from the Soviet days and a few rocket-propelled grenade launchers. His side had everything you could have asked for, mines, mortars, and most important of all, many loyal men. Manan and his 3 fellow commanders decided to rest the troops here and hit the road again at first light. Settling in next to a tire, he listened as his men chattered away under the stars. A few were already asleep, stretched out on the backs of their trucks. Somewhere in Tirinkot, he thought, Hamid Karzai and his insurgents were probably finishing their own meal, getting ready to turn in for the night. They'll be fast asleep, Manan realized. If his men moved now, they could strike before Karzai even knew what hit him. He mentioned the idea to the other commanders, but they were united in opposition. Karzai's group could just as easily be handled at daybreak, they said, especially since intelligence reports indicated an enemy numbering no more than 20 poorly equipped fighters. To Manan, it seemed that the element of surprise should never be squandered, but he kept these thoughts to himself. He had never been one to invite confrontation. Instead, he'd always tried to be all things to all people, the consummate diplomat. It was how God had made him, and it had gotten him this far without a problem. He curled up next to his tire, and the night fell silent. The sky paled, and the muezzin sang, and Manan awoke to say his prayers. The others clambered onto their trucks and started the engines. He checked his walkie-talkie and his rifle, a trusty semi-automatic in use since the Russian days, and rolled out to near the middle of the convoy. As they picked up speed, Manan noted that the 8-truck convoy bringing supplies had never shown up. There must have been confusion at headquarters, an occurrence far too frequent for his taste. The trucks carried the men through the empty reddish desert. Up ahead lay the Tirinkot Pass, a narrow defile cut into the coppery mountains that formed Uruzgan's natural southern wall. The town lay 12 miles from the pass, the mountains extending in a semicircle around it, like half of a giant earthen bowl. As the first touches of orange streaked the eastern sky, Manon's radio came to life.
"I can see the governor's house," said his friend Rahim from the lead vehicle.
Rahim had made it through the pass and was inside the bowl, a good mile ahead of him. They would reach the town in no time. As the pass appeared, Manon appeared to steer through. It was then he noticed the sound of planes, not too far away. It was near 4 a.m. when Hamid Karzai showed up at Amarine's command center with a small band of guerrillas he had managed to cobble together, many of them friends and relatives of John Muhammad. Amarine loaded the recruits and his own team onto pickups and headed for the Tirinkot Pass. The vehicles drove across the rolling earth through a web of hills that stretched for miles. The desert eventually gave way to a 200-foot-high ridgeline, and the trucks pulled to a stop. It was a perfect vantage point overlooking the pass, 2 miles off. From here, the Afghan guerrillas could fire rocket-propelled grenades, and Amarine's men could call in airstrikes. The Afghans were placed in fighting positions, and the Green Berets set to work establishing communications with air support. Not long after, the team spotted dust clouds near the pass. Amarine glassed the area with his binoculars and saw something coming straight toward them. It was moving fast, and it was not a car or a truck. It looked like an armored personnel carrier. He issued an order, and Sergeant Yoshimoto radioed to the F-18s waiting above. Moments later, the air pulsed with a massive boom, but the vehicle appeared untouched. A second airstrike sent a shockwave across the basin. When the smoke cleared, all he could see was a burning lump of metal. Amarine turned to his guerrillas, but they were scrambling back to their vehicles. After the first bomb missed, they decided that they'd seen enough. "Hey, what the fuck is going on?" a soldier shouted. "Where are they going?" The first trucks pulled away. Amarine and his team would be stranded, left to the Taliban. For a moment, he contemplated shooting the drivers. But what would Karzai think, or the townsfolk? He'd have to go with them, even if that meant abandoning the position. He and the other Green Berets jumped onto the last vehicles, and they were about to speed off. The developing situation had now caught the attention of command centers in Pakistan and back home. A dozen or so Green Berets were facing the largest Taliban assault of the entire year, and every available air asset across the theater was directed to Uruzgan. Meanwhile, a few miles away, Mullah Manan eased his vehicles through the pass. When he emerged, he gasped. Rahim's armored personnel carrier was a heap of burning metal and billowing smoke. He looked skyward for planes. Nothing. For a moment, he considered stopping to look for bodies, but the basin was too exposed. He pressed ahead, toward a shallow ridgeline. Back in Tirinkot, the Americans unloaded the guerrillas and drove two jeeps back themselves to a small hillock just outside of town. Amarine surveyed the area. If the Taliban made it past here, he knew he wouldn't be able to bring himself to authorize airstrikes. Not with all those people, all those houses. If Taliban trucks breached this point, the town would be theirs. Mullah Manan forced himself to concentrate on the road. He told himself that Rahim was resourceful, that he would have made it out somehow. He'd go back for him after securing Tirinkot. His vehicle was now moving so fast that every bump sent a jolt of pain up his spine. This blitzkrieg-style attack, which he'd learned against the Northern Alliance, almost always caught the enemy off guard. He estimated he was about 6 miles from town. On the hill, Amarine received word from pilots that the Taliban trucks had split into three columns. "Put it all on the center column for now," he said. Manan was focused on keeping a tight distance from the truck in front of him when a massive blast slammed the column to his right, spewing dust everywhere. It felt like an earthquake. "The Americans are here," he thought, searching the sky. On the hill, the Green Berets were busy coordinating strikes. When Amarine looked up, he saw Tirinkot residents, men, women, and children, emerging from their homes, coming up to the hill to watch them work. News of the awe-inspiring strikes was spreading, and cheers erupted with every blast. Many of the onlookers were John Muhammad's tribespeople. By now, vehicles were exploding into flames all around Manan. Yet, scanning the ridgelines, he couldn't see a soul anywhere. Where were the Americans? What kind of impossibly advanced machines were they using? This wasn't a battle, not when you couldn't even see your enemies. No, it was some sort of wizardry, majestic and cowardly all at once. He pressed his sandaled foot to the pedal and barreled ahead. He was now 4 miles from town. Amarine had a problem. There were just too many trucks. The sky was stacked with at least 30 aircraft, but there was no end to the Taliban vehicles pouring out of the pass. Short on payload, pilots began strafing runs, which he knew would expose them to anti-aircraft fire. But with the convoy largely intact, there seemed to be no choice. That was the first time Mullah Manan actually spotted one of the planes. It swooped in, firing rapidly at the column to the east, and he saw windshields fracture and heard a tire somewhere pop. Already the column was breaking up. Trucks struggled to turn around or lay jackknifed across the road. But Manan was not panicking. It looked like there were just one or two planes in the fight, and they were targeting the other columns. His drove on untouched. "They must not be able to see us," he thought. He was now only 3 miles from town. "Work on the western column, and then the eastern one," Amarine ordered. Within moments, a jet dove toward Manan. He heard machine gun fire and looked up to see the plane's belly flash past. The first vehicle hit was a food truck, which crashed into a second truck, scattering loaves of flatbread everywhere. Manan swerved, only to see another jet speeding toward him. He veered off the road just as it flew past, machine gunning a truck behind him. Grabbing his walkie-talkie, he screamed, "Turn around!" Amarine received news of the arrival of a fresh wave of jets carrying 500-pound bombs, which they were dropping up and down the column. Manan looked up. The sky filled with an almost deafening roar. He started praying, promising God that if he made it out of this, he'd quit fighting forever. Driving back toward the pass, he ran into a stream of oncoming trucks. Vehicles were stacking up in both directions, a traffic jam right there amid the hills. Without hesitating, Manan slammed on the brakes, tossed aside his weapon, leapt out, and ran, heading east toward the sunrise. He didn't look back. On the hill, Amarine caught sight of a truck that had somehow made it all the way to Tirinkot. Suddenly, machine gun fire erupted somewhere nearby. For a dark moment, he thought the Taliban had penetrated the town. But then he saw it was the townsfolk firing at the truck, sending the driver scrambling away. Everywhere, explosions echoed through the basin. Manan's fighters were abandoning their vehicles and fleeing on foot. The townsfolk jumped into trucks to give chase. Those they caught, they executed. The battle was over, and soon the Taliban would be as well. News of the victory at Tirinkot spread fast, spurring Taliban officials throughout the south to defect. But it could easily have been otherwise. When I described Mullah Manan's account of the battle to Jason Amarine, he leaned back thoughtfully. Had Manan convinced his comrades to drive on through the night, Amarine said, his team would not have been in position in time. "We would have lost. We wouldn't have held Tirinkot because there was no way I could have bombed the town." For 2 days the Green Berets waited for a counterattack, but nothing came. Still, Amarine knew the war wouldn't be over until Kandahar City was theirs, and he prepared to march south with Karzai's growing guerrilla army. Before leaving, however, he wanted to fully explore the area. There was one valley in particular, about 10 miles due east, yet to be visited. When he raised the possibility with Karzai, though, it was dismissed. "The guerrillas shouldn't venture there," Karzai said, "because they don't like us, and we don't like them." In that very valley, Mullah Manan was sitting in a stranger's home, shell-shocked and nursing his wounded ambitions. He had hiked for hours through a maze of hills in order to seek refuge among his clan, members of the Gilzai tribe confederation. They had long been marginalized in an Uruzgan dominated by the Popalzai and related tribes. The Taliban had upset this hierarchy, the sole reason a poor Gilzai farmer like Manan could ever have risen to command hundreds. In steering Amarine away, Karzai understood what his American friends did not yet grasp. Not only individuals, but entire tribal communities were winners and losers in the invasion. Time would reveal this in a most painful way. More than anything, Manan wanted to hear from his comrades in the convoy, or from the Kandahar leadership, or from anyone at all with news. But for 3 days, he heard nothing. He needed direction, a sense of how the others were coping, an idea of what would come next. He would have to risk a trip to his home valley. Walking up the dusty bazaar road of his hometown, he headed toward the office of a town mayor, a friend of his. Just then, a shopkeeper stepped out and shouted, "Where is your weapon now?" Someone else jeered, "You call yourself a man. Go home to your wife." 5 years of Taliban authority were crumbling before his eyes. A week earlier, these shopkeepers would have hugged him and prayed for his safety. It was hard to believe. At government headquarters, he learned that the mayor had fled, along with his assistants, the gardener, the tea boy, and the night watchman. Manan headed home. Embracing his sisters and parents, he recounted his harrowing escape. Then he went to the backyard and hoisted himself onto the mud wall overlooking their tiny wheat field. There was his brother, hunched over in sweat, as always. He turned down the fighter's life for a chance to run the farm. At that moment, as his brother turned the soil with his bare hands, Manan saw the honor of simple work, the type that belongs to you alone. That month, thousands of Taliban confronted the same reality. Their movement had failed a great test of endurance and legitimacy. Now the mandate of authority was passing to the Americans and their Afghan allies. On November 30th, almost 2 weeks after the Battle of Tirinkot, Jason Amerine's Green Berets escorted Hamid Karzai and his CIA handlers to Kandahar with a caravan of Afghan militiamen and tribal elders. Along the way, they passed through the battle-scarred hills of the failed Taliban assault. The roadside dotted here and there with circles of rocks, hasty graves erected wherever fighters had fallen. On reaching Uruzgan's southernmost mountains, the edge of the bowl, they stopped at the same ramshackle village that had hosted Manan's forces a few weeks earlier. Thousands of miles away, in Bonn, Germany, various Afghan political factions were meeting to decide on a post-Taliban government. The Northern Alliance held the majority of delegate seats, followed by an assortment of groups associated with the former King Zahir Shah, in exile since 1973. After much wrangling, Abdul Sattar Sirat, an ethnic Uzbek close to the king, was chosen as the country's interim president. Hamid Karzai, whose stock had been soaring since the Tirinkot battle, was awarded the vice presidency. The following day, Amerine's team stopped about 15 miles north of Kandahar City at an eerily silent and apparently deserted town. Everything was still, except for the Taliban signature white flags flapping atop the buildings. As the team pressed closer, Kalashnikov fire erupted nearby. It was a leftover Taliban contingent, putting up last-ditch resistance. Over 15 hours, the Green Berets and Afghan insurgents slowly advanced through the wadis and fields, getting into close-range firefights and calling in airstrikes. At times, the fighting grew intense. One Green Beret survived a bullet through the neck, but the Americans eventually captured a strategic hill overlooking the main tributary flowing into Kandahar. By the next morning, the outpost had been transformed into a hub of operations for the insurgency, with local elders streaming in for audiences with Karzai. Around 8:30 a.m., Karzai headed to a command post to meet some newly arrived tribal leaders who had come bearing an important message. Suddenly, everything exploded. Windows burst. Slabs of the ceiling came crashing down, and Karzai was thrown to the ground. When he looked up, he saw smoke and blood and groaning, soot-covered men. The Americans had called in an airstrike on themselves. Although threat of a Taliban counterattack had been minimal, American bombing had continued, largely on orders of Amerine's superior, who had flown in to join the mission. In the process, an errant 2,000-pound satellite-guided bomb struck their own encampment. Miraculously, Karzai escaped with only bruises, but some of his most trusted commanders were killed. In all, 5 Afghans lost their lives in the blast, along with 3 American soldiers, and many more were wounded, Amerine among them. He was evacuated from the country. Minutes after the blast, Karzai's satellite phone rang with a call from the BBC's Lise Doucet.
"What's your reaction to being named as Prime Minister?" she asked.
It was news to Karzai. Behind the scenes, U.S. officials had been busy reversing the decision that Afghan groups had reached in Germany. The Americans had apparently wanted their own man, a Pashtun, in the presidential palace. Moments later, Karzai got another dose of surprising news. The Taliban were sending a delegation to meet him. After 2 months in hiding, Mullah Omar was losing his grip. Initially, he had exhorted his senior lieutenants to fight on, assuring them that he was ready to leave everything and to believe only in Islam and my Afghan bravery. But his mettle deserted him after the war's fateful first night. Since then, he had been hiding in the houses of close friends, emerging only at nightfall. He was suffering from apocalyptic dreams and anguish over his decision not to surrender bin Laden. His moods veered wildly between intense defiance, including pledges to fight to the death, and bouts of boundless terror that brought him close to tears. Even worse, the rest of the Taliban leadership, who had come to see their causes hopeless, were pressing him to capitulate. 2 weeks before the Battle of Tirin Khat, Omar had ordered his assistant to reach out to Karzai through tribal intermediaries to explore the possibility of surrender. Karzai had received the call on his satellite phone at the airbase in Pakistan, as Jason Amarin sat within earshot, and passed the message to the CIA, who reportedly relayed it all the way up to Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. The Taliban leader hinted that he was seeking a face-saving abdication of power, which meant an honorable immunity, in the words of an associate. Rumsfeld's response was clear and direct. Washington would accept nothing short of unconditional surrender. After the defeat in Tirin Khat, the Taliban leadership gathered secretly at a house in Kandahar City. Throughout the afternoon, an increasingly sullen Omar pleaded with the others to head for the mountains and launch a guerrilla war. "But this wasn't happening," a top military commander told me later. "We all knew time was up. Fate laughs at even the best schemes." His back to the wall, Mullah Omar drew up a letter to Hamid Karzai, acknowledging his selection as interim president. The letter also granted Omar's ministers, deputies, and aides the right to surrender and formalized the handover of his vehicles, books, and other possessions to tribal elders. On December 5th, a Taliban delegation arrived at the U.S. Special Forces camp north of Kandahar City to officially relinquish power. According to a participant, Karzai was asked that he allow Mullah Omar to live in dignity in exchange for his quiescence. The delegation members, which included Defense Minister Mullah Obeidullah, Omar's trusted aide Tayeb Agha, and other key leaders, pledged to retire from politics and return to their home villages. Crucially, they also agreed that their movement would surrender arms, effectively ensuring that the Taliban could no longer function as a military entity. There would be no jihad, no resistance from the Taliban to the new order, even as leaders of Al-Qaeda were escaping to Pakistan to continue their holy war. The differences between the two groups may have never been so apparent, but as Washington declared victory, they passed largely unnoticed. It was December 7th, less than 2 months since the first American bomb had fallen. Across Afghanistan, men and women looked with wondrous anticipation toward the end of 21 years of war. In Kandahar, a convoy of Afghan militiamen, Green Berets, and Karzai with his CIA escorts snaked through acres of farmland and approached the dusty outskirts of the city. As they entered the mud-walled maze of narrow streets, they passed a large irrigation tunnel. Inside, Mullah Omar and other senior Taliban leaders were huddled together, fearing that, despite Karzai's promises, they would be handed over to the Americans. Later that evening, as Karzai and the Americans occupied Mullah Omar's home and announced the official end of the Taliban regime, as crowds celebrated in Kabul and other cities across Afghanistan, as the world heralded the end of one of the most oppressive governments in memory, Mullah Omar stepped out of the tunnel. With the open country before him, he bid farewell to his friends and said that they should attempt to contact him no more. They were now and forever on their own. Then he climbed aboard an old Honda motorcycle, drove out along the highway, and disappeared into the desert. The day that Karzai survived a U.S. bomb and learned that he had been selected president, a prisoner was walked out of his cell and into the courtyard of a Kandahar prison. The sun weighed down heavily. The guards gathered in the shade. No words were spoken, as dozens of eyes fixed on the condemned. Then a door to the courtyard banged open, and a man strode in, followed by a group of bodyguards. John Muhammad recognized him as a high-ranking Taliban official. He watched as the man whispered something to the warden. The pair walked toward John Muhammad. The warden reached behind him and slipped a key into his wrist shackles. He stared at them.
"Is this a joke?"
It was all that he could think to say.
"I hope you'll forgive us for what we did to you," the official said.
He then undid the cuffs to the other prisoner, Muhammad Nabi.
"You are free. A car is waiting outside."
Karzai had not forgotten his promise. Upon meeting the Taliban delegation, he'd stated that he would accept their surrender on one condition, the immediate release of his dear friend, John Muhammad. Muhammad was driven to the American camp, and when Karzai first caught sight of him, he burst into tears. After they embraced, he took a step back and gasped. His once corpulent friend had shriveled up, skin hanging from his bones. Only in Karzai's camp did Muhammad finally learn about the events of the previous 2 months, of 9/11, the U.S. invasion, and the Taliban's impending demise. He drove home to Uruzgan to see his family and returned the next day with scores of jubilant tribesmen. The following day, the whole group would march with the Americans into Kandahar City, Afghanistan's political crucible, as men of power. When I met him years later, John Muhammad's ample frame had filled out. He was living once again in a world of supplicants and hangers-on. I had sought out Mullah Cable to understand the U.S. invasion from the perspective of the losers, and now I was meeting Muhammad to explore just what it had meant for the winners, and few had won as much as he. It was a quintessentially Kabul meeting, the cluttered living room with its gaudy leather couches still in their plastic covers, the glass coffee table, the portrait of Karzai hung proudly on the wall, the children peeking in shyly from behind a kitchen door. John Muhammad showed me how his body had become a battlefield over the years, bearing the remnants of Soviet slugs and Taliban torture. A coarse gray beard hung wildly from his jowls, and a turban sat so haphazardly atop his head that you had to fight the urge to reach over and straighten it. One eye was damaged and useless, the other squinted at you with a touch of suspicion. I asked him what his initial thoughts had been upon his release, and he replied that from his first free step, he was consumed by a single idea. It churned inside him, invaded his dreams, and gripped his imagination. It commandeered his public life, even though he knew it was wrong, and it had destroyed many of his personal relationships. He looked at me with an unflinching stare and said,
"I wanted revenge."